a meaningful rebound in commodity prices, particularly over the last month. Copper, lithium is one of the best performing metals this year, and copper has just had a completely strong rebound. I'll let Scott kick into it with the introductions.
Sure, yeah. So let me do formal introductions here. We're pleased to be joined by Aurora Davidson. She's CEO of copper producer Amerigo Resources, and also Rob Weir. He's VP of Corporate Development at Lithium Royalty Corp. Thank you guys both for joining us. Now, I just want to kick things off with you, Aurora. So last time we spoke, you gave us an excellent overview on the outlook for copper. You talked about the drivers of higher expected prices. So now we've seen, since the lows in October, copper's up 40 cents a pound. Pretty strong move. Just curious what you think is driving the rally in prices right now. I mean, is it something going on in China? Is it the mine disruptions we've heard a lot about? Would love to get your thoughts on things.
Yeah, I think it's both. What we're seeing essentially, and we've talked about this before, is supply is failing to keep up with demand. Whenever we speak of copper demand, we have to discuss China. The news that we have been getting out of China is good news. The Chinese PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, in March was strong. It continues to be very robust. The construction sector is not thought to have yet reached bottom, but we continue to see that demand is being brought in by green demand in China. This occurred through 2023. So, you know, also China has gone through their annual seasonal copper stock build in the first quarter, so that is now over. But beyond China, ex-China, we're seeing also signs of a bottoming of industrial cycle downturn that we saw in the last year or so. Global PMIs expanded in February. They expanded again in March. And there is a very interesting story that I can briefly discuss, which is India. India has actually the strongest global PMI in March. And last year, copper demand in India grew 16%. This is huge. They expect continued double-digit growth this year. The growth is coming across the board, infrastructure, EVs, technology, you name it. And India has actually now surpassed Japan as the world's second biggest car manufacturer. So just to give you some perspective here, one study says that for each $1 million growth in Indian GDP, we have an additional 300 kilograms growth in copper demand. So that's with respect to the demand. Now, as you know, I've talked a lot about the issues of current copper supply and the risk associated with that. Last year, we had Cobre Panama shutter down. That means 1.5% of global copper mine supply basically went offline. We had revisions of downward production guidance by major producers. And as Q1 reporting starts to roll out, we're seeing that continuing to be the case. Ivanhoe Mines reported a 6.5% decline in their Q1 copper production this year compared to last year. So in general terms, we have a situation where consumption is outpacing supply and the mine supply cannot be turned on, as you know, like a light switch. And beyond the supply and demand dynamics, there are other macro factors. One important aspect for sure is the expectation that monetary policy will be easing and that we will be seeing rate cuts occurring later this year, probably in the summer. And with lower rates, the U.S. dollar will tend to weaken, making it cheaper for non-dollar holders to buy copper.
That was a great overview. Thank you, Aurora. Now, I wanted to just ask you, fundamentally, is $4 a pound, is that enough, you think, for supply to keep up with surging demand this decade? Or do we really need higher prices to see that kind of greenfield exploration that we saw a lot of earlier last decade?
Look, a $4 per pound price is not an incentive price. And this is shown by the lack of projects that have been sanctioned in recent years. Miners have slowed expansion for a number of reasons. We have higher capital costs, higher projected operational costs. We have had inflationary pressures. There is a declining quality of new projects. And this is quite significant. Lower grades, high regulation, complex permitting. and increased resource nationalism, like what we saw with Cobre Panama. So actually, the last time a batch of copper projects was approved on the back of copper prices, stronger copper prices, was 2017-2018. So $4 does not seem to make the mark. One incentive price that is quoted, and this is just one data point, is $11,000 a ton. That's essentially $5 a pound. But that's just one price point. There's Robert Friedland. You may, question some of his comments, but he's speaking of an incentive price of $6.80 per pound for copper miners to be truly incentivized to bring in new projects. When we look at the incentive price, Scott, I think one key aspect to look at is the correlation between copper grades. Copper grade, as you know, is the amount of copper contained in the ore, and copper price. Copper prices were lower when copper was being mined from higher grade mines or from higher grade mine sectors. But as copper grades decrease, and we have a very steep line of grade decline plotted from 2002 on, copper prices are higher. Copper prices are required to have economic processes. There's a wonderful graph people can find online. I wish we could have an interactive presentation here that shows the additional capacity of copper coming online from Sectron products between 2007 and 2022, and we can see that the peak in new capacity occurred in 2010. And it has been dropping dramatically. The stronger copper prices we started seeing in 2021 have not incentivized miners to invest as they did between 2010, 2012. And the new capacity that is coming online now is mostly coming from expansion. From expansion projects, not from greenfields, as it used to occur. So we can find different incentive prices mentioned here or there, but what remains a fact is that we need over $200 million of investment in the next 10 years to fill projected copper deficits.
That's great. We'll definitely talk more about that. There's a chart that I'll try to put up that I think may be the one you're talking about. But just I wanted to kick things over to Rob for a minute just to talk about lithium. So for anyone who hasn't been following the lithium market, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. There was a big price spike in 2022 on some kind of acute shortages, and then we had an equally dramatic fall over the past 12 months. Rob, I just wanted to get your take. How should investors think about supply and demand right now? Kind of was the volatility we saw, was it all supply driven? Was it demand softening? What's driven this volatility we've seen lately?
Yeah, Scott, I think you came off some very frothy highs coming out of the pandemic. Lithium carbonate got to 80,000. Spodumene got to 8. We gave back 83% of those gains last year. Very reminiscent of prior cycles. In 2018, we saw a 73% decline. But I think worth bearing in mind, the five-year average is up about 160. So long-term consensus prices continue to build. And that's probably the metric we look at the most, although the market rightfully cues off the GFEX price and what's happening here short term. Unlike copper, it's a very nascent market. It just got to under 1 million tons. Copper is, I think, 27 million tons. So as lithium demand continues to build, any annual changes in demand supply will have a much lower impact on the actual price. So, we've been through this before, and I think the key attribute here is that electrification continues to grow, and we've got 5% of new vehicle sales now in 31 countries. So that denominator continues to grow.
That's great. Now, I wanted to talk about China for a minute. How should we think of Chinese supply? I mean, is China an irrational player who will just keep pushing supply on the market? Or are you lately, with prices coming down, are you seeing some rational decisions being made there with the pricing where it is?
Yeah, I think you're seeing a bit of both. I think the very low cost producers are continuing to expand or organically. The fact is that demand was up 30% last year, which is multiples of GDP growth. It's still going to grow 20-25%. Any inventory destocking, you know, we think has largely run its course. China is interesting. The very low grade lepidolite, came up in a pretty dramatic fashion. There's been a number of environmental inspections happening in those various provinces, and there's some very elements that are worse than mercury in the slag. So, I think the marginal cost now north of 20,000 a ton on LCE basis makes those uneconomic. So our anticipation that those start to be removed from the marketplace and we get a better picture as we get into the second half of 24.
So I did read an article recently that there is some supply curtailment going on in China. Are you seeing production shutdown or kind of the cancellations or delays in the mine developments in other parts of the world? Like, is this a sign? So my question is, are you seeing other shutdowns? And then if so, is this a sign that supply and demand balance is going to be improving or is improving?
It's definitely improving. I think Goldman's the most bearish, and they had a north of a 300,000 ton surplus over the course of 24-25. I think they've moderated that view. You have seen over 150,000 direct supply cuts. And then inevitably, given the lack of access to debt and equity capital, project deferrals and things are pushed out 6, 9, 12 months, if not longer. So with EV demand continuing apace, the market's going to be in deficit in pretty short order.
Great. Now, I just want to ask you something for people who might not know lithium production that well. Could you tell us what type of lithium production is the lowest cost currently and what you guys think will be the dominant future supply source in your view? Like, you know, the brine evaporation pools that the media loves to put pictures of in all the articles, are those kind of on the way out, or what's the best new source of lithium that you guys are seeing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the brines are here to stay. We're certainly of the view that high grade hard rock assets are a big part of the future supply. We have two projects this year operated by Zijin and Ganfeng that are both brines in Argentina. But the vast majority of our portfolio is hard rock assets in Australia, Brazil, and Canada. And we think that's the most sustainable source of future supply.
That's helpful. Now, similar to my question to Aurora about $4 per pound. Now, have you seen any good research on if current lithium prices are below marginal costs for the industry as a whole? I assume the answer is yes, if we see supply coming out of the market. That's kind of how it works. But I'm curious, does Lithium Royalty have house view on kind of what lithium price is needed to bring on enough supply to meet this exploding demand from EVs and other sources?
Yeah, I think the easy answer is they certainly have to be higher than where they are today. We've seen a number of producers conduct auctions on both Metals Hub and BMX, and those prices were done at over $1,200 US a ton. And that's anywhere from 20 to 25% above sort of the prevailing spot price. Even first quartile projects are coming online with operating costs that are anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 times higher than their DFS. So as I said earlier, I think the marginal cost of the Chinese lepidolite is in and around 20,000 tons or $20,000 per ton. So, prices at a minimum, at least for hard rock, have to be sustainably over 1500, if not 2000, to get companies in a position to be able to capitalize and put the money in the ground.
Great. Now, Aurora, I wanted to go back to that kind of the chart you were talking about and industries like lack of exploration. So S&P, I know, puts out a really good data each year where they track how much new supply is coming from mines. Is it exploration? Is it current mines? And that's probably what you're referring to, where they show that there's been like very little new copper supply from any exploration. Almost, it's basically all come from their mining. And they explore more around where the mine is and they find a little more copper, but that's not sustainable. So I'm just wondering, you've been in the copper market for a long time. Historically, what happens to prices when the market starts perceiving that copper is in a growing shortage scenario, like we could be entering now? Like, is that where you typically see big moves in prices? Just give us a little bit of history, if you could.
Sure. Well, you know, when demand increases and supply cannot keep up, in any market, we have a mismatch and commodity prices steeply rise, right? We have seen that in the copper market before. We essentially get into a period of what you could call a scarcity pricing. Now, in theory, the price will increase and continue increasing until supply and demand reach equilibrium again. What is interesting in the case of copper, as we have discussed already, is that supply is very difficult to come by. It is capital intensive and time intensive. This is not, as I've said before, it's not a switch that you just turn on. And then there are also a series of geographical and political intricacies in the copper market. In essence, the copper production chain has three big boundaries. We have the mines that produce the copper concentrate. We have the smelters and refiners that transform the concentrate into cathodes. And we have the manufacturers of the copper semi-manufactured products, such as the wire rod, the bars, the tubes, etc. So there are three different islands of players. Now, Chile is key to long-term copper supply because it has more than 20% of global copper reserves. But on the other hand, refined copper production is dominated by China and by the rest of Asia. So we have different geographical points of inflection with respect to the different plays of the market. What's happening with the mine production? What's happening with the smelter that yields out the refined copper? Now, substitution. When you're talking about a higher price, you talk about substitution. Yes, substitution can play a role, but I could argue that the growth in copper consumption since 2000 has been already much slower than the growth in aluminum consumption, for example, because aluminum, being cheaper, has already substituted copper wherever it can. We have societal factors into the equation as well. We have wars, you know, international conflicts, economic cycles that all have a direct effect on copper demand cycles. The S&P report that you are talking about, Scott, alludes to a copper scarcity coming around that could cause major economic disruptions and may even become an international destabilizing event. We know that there is not much more supply coming online for the rest of the decade. We know that a higher incentive price is required to bring additional capacity online. And then there are significant time constraints to bring that supply online. So this can all be indicative of new market dynamics that will establish a new floor price, for copper, as occurred in 2000.
This space was downloaded via spacesdown.com. Visit to download your spaces today.
Three, with the industrialization and urbanization of China. Just as a reference, copper prices were around 80 cents per pound when they took off to the current sort of cycle of significantly higher prices we have seen in the last 20 years. So we may be facing a similar step up in the floor price of copper.
So when we look at commodities, we know that there's always volatility. So it probably isn't a scenario where do you think the price action we've seen so far in copper, where it's going up slowly, but there's not we're not seeing massive spikes yet. Do you think that tells us that we're still in that early period where people realize there may be an issue, but it's not in the here and now, there's not significant shortages of copper where we may be getting to that point. And then when you get to that point where people start to get nervous, you do kind of always across the commodity spectrum, you can see big moves in price, right? It's not always just a little slow growth year after year. That's not really how commodity prices work in markets.
Correct. You're right. I mean, we've seen a lot of sideways trading in copper for the last 2 years. I'm actually surprised that it has taken this long for copper prices to start to recover. I don't think we have reached a point where we say this is it and this is where we're going to be staying. I think that we're still looking at, all in all, stable supply conditions. And what is evident is that we have very little inventory capacity to absorb any seasonal changes, right? Inventories have been drawn down. There's very little buffer that way. So I think that we're starting to see a movement towards a more sustainable copper price environment that will be incentivizing of bringing in the additional demand that is, sorry, the additional supply that is required and known to be required. I mean, this is not surprising. We've been seeing these reports about the supply gap and the different degrees of severity of that supply gap for years. But at the same time, we're facing tight economic conditions, contraction in manufacturing the last 2 years that kind of held that explosion in demand back. But I think that we're starting to get into that territory where we were expected to be maybe 18, 24 months ago. So this is an early stage of a new cycle buildup, in my opinion.
Yeah, Aurora, I think about that statement you made a lot, and I just think about, you know, how well copper held in versus all other industrial metals. And really, that is kind of that point, right? The fact that it holding in kind of was telling you something beyond, it kind of had transcended Dr. Copper, if you know what I'm trying to say, right? Like last year kind of showed you that Dr. Copper, that sensitivity has maybe been decoupled, at least on the downside. And now we're seeing a recoupling of Dr. Copper. The price is moving with all this economic activity.
Exactly. I think there were two different drivers of market forces, as you were saying. Traditionally, if we had seen, if we didn't have that buildup of new green demand coming online, we would have seen a significantly steeper correction in copper prices. We didn't see it. So now we're having the double whammy of that continued green demand coming online. We have the recovery in the traditional manufacturing cycles, and we also have the supply constraints. So if you put that all into your blender, you have definitely all the conditions to establish a new price economics for copper.
Great.
And I just make a comment. It seems from where we're sitting that there's incremental sources of even more copper demand that have come up like in the last year. If you look at the whole AI build out, that's incentivized these companies to now spend billions of dollars on copper heavy data centers that they wouldn't have been spending that much money on if AI hadn't come around. That certainly seems incremental to me. Like 2 years ago, people were building that into their copper demand model. So if anything, copper demand is growing even faster than those S&P expectations. I think the last time they did their report was more than a year ago, and that was pre-AI, you know, CapEx cycle. So demand seems to be getting better and better.
That is correct. Yeah, that wasn't factored in, right? When we were talking about projected sources of incremental new demand coming online, we were talking about EVs, we were talking about charging stations, we were talking about big electrification projects. AI was not even mentioned. Now it's part of the menu.
And all I hear from the AI creators is that they just want to use more and more copper because it makes the chips more efficient. So it's good for any copper investor.
Absolutely. You cannot use aluminum, going back to my substitution comparative that I used earlier on.
Yeah. A question, Scott, for Rob on the lithium side. So prior to my eyes being dilated when I couldn't read this morning, I saw a tweet that basically Ford and Rob, you can correct me. I know you're on top of this. It's just in terms of, you know, they're going to de-emphasize EV and focus more on hybrid electric. Just maybe your thoughts on what that means in aggregate with respect to, like, if more of the fleet is going to go hybrid electric, maybe that's, you know, like, let's say it's 50% and you're taking some of the maybe traditional combustion engine stuff, and like that maybe could, like, that could be a net positive scenario. Or the other side, the bear case, is that, okay, well, now whatever percentage was EVs, sales are now going to go hybrid electric, and that's going to require less lithium. Maybe you can share some thoughts on how you see it playing out for the non-Teslas of the world. And then, further to that, we saw that I'm going to slaughter the pronunciation. Scott, maybe you could give it the Xiaomi or the Chinese automaker that made that like really sweet car that I forget who they modeled it off of, but it looked amazing. But
there's a lot of those cars. They're either really cheap and they do like what you need, or they're like pretty high quality and you know, a little bit cheaper than a typical car in the US. So it seems like they're significant competitors.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm kind of like looking at all these kind of different things happening. Like, well, on one side you have Ford kind of saying we're not doing EV anymore. On the other side, you have China kind of like not like knocking the lights out in terms of what they're doing. And then how hybrid electrics play in all this. Maybe you can kind of guide me through what I should be thinking.
Sure. I think the OEM in China you referenced, that's the model Y killer. I think if you look at electrification through the lens of Ford and GM, it kind of distorts what's really happening in the world. And as Scott alluded to, I think, you know, China has a pretty considerable lead, not only from an OEM perspective, but all of the conversion capacity resides there. So, you know, Toyota's been a big proponent that hybrids were the bridge from ICE to EV. And I think they've been right. If you look carefully at what they're doing, they're spending $14 billion in North Carolina to build a battery plant. Hyundai, Kia have put an EV9 out, the first family 7-seat SUV, and they've seen rave reviews from that. You know, BMW had 15% of sales being electric. So Tesla's obvious, and then you add in all the different Chinese OEMs. There's almost 650 different models out there for consumers. So you know, Ford and GM are way behind, and maybe that works for them, but when you look at demand, and as I said earlier, that embedded demand now in 31 countries, you're at that point where you start to see mass adoptions for any new disruptive technology. So, you know, I think there's a lot of positives that the media tends to focus on those two OEMs specifically for whatever the reason.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Yeah, and so you're kind of, we're looking at it through this American lens. And I guess that's the real difference here, and that it feels like on the innovation side, these American OEMs just, you know, they just can't seem to get over that hurdle where's Asia, or, you know, it just feels like you almost have to start from scratch, right? Like Scott, what are the other electric vehicle manufacturers in North America? What's that? They have the truck. What's that one? That like super, super nice.
Oh, those are some of the like really high flying stocks from the COVID period.
Yeah.
That have now come back down to earth. I'm just blanking the name, but I know that some of them, like that one company you're thinking of, they had a major recall where they basically had to recall every car because there was an issue within a crash.
Oh, right.
The battery could explode. So that's issues just with the, when you have startup car companies, they're figuring it all out and they don't have the same processes in place as like a Ford or GM.
Yeah.
But at the same point, I'm just surprised how floundering it feels like some of the bigger car companies are, where Ford went from, we're going to open four new F-150 Lightning plants, we're going to make 500,000 a year or whatever. Now they have all the way to, we're not going to launch a SUV that's full electric anymore. We're going to do a hybrid. So they just seem to kind of not have a clear strategy and just like floundering and trying to chase what's happening versus like Chinese competitors, the pure electric companies. They have a plan and they're just executing, because as Rob said, demand is still very strong. I think some of it may have been pulled forward during COVID. That's why you're seeing like a little softening now, but you're still seeing really fast growth. It's just less fast growth than a year ago.
Right. Yeah. Rob, maybe just an auxiliary question too, because I always just think also the penetration of lithium batteries is far beyond, obviously, from a absolute volume perspective, EVs are definitely the most important lever, but surely, you know, as batteries proliferate in consumer goods, and you know, I'm talking the plethora from consumer electronics all the way to like scooters or electric bikes, like is the market giving enough weight to that growing wedge, or is that kind of like, or is that not as growing as, is that not as impactful to volume? Maybe your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it helps. I think the lithium intensity is obviously much lower. I think a bigger factor is energy storage. And if you look at, you can charge in Ontario at night for 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour, but it's actually more carbon intensive in other geographies to charge at night because renewables are offline. So energy storage gives you the ability to capture the solar or wind during peak periods and use it when those sources are offline. So yeah, I think those help, but electrification of transportation is definitely the driving force here. You're seeing PACCAR and Cummins spend $2 billion on a commercial EV plant down in Mississippi. So those big infrastructure investments, I think, are material sources of long-term demand versus those other modalities.
Great, thank you. I'll swing it over to Scott.
Yeah, so maybe I just want to switch a little bit to hear you guys talk a bit about what your companies do for people who don't know. Could you maybe just each chime in with just a very quick overview of Amerigo and Lithium Royalty? I don't know, maybe Aurora go first and then Rob can jump in.
Sure. Thanks for that, Scott. Yeah, Amerigo produces copper. We're a copper producer, but we produce copper from the waste material of the world's largest underground copper mine, which is Codelco's El Teniente mine. This waste material is called tailings, and Amerigo is the only company in the world producing copper from tailings at the rate that we do. We produce around 65 million pounds of copper a year, which makes us essentially the equivalent to a mid-sized copper producer. We have one operation called MVC. It's located in Chile. It has been in operation for more than 30 years uninterruptedly. We bought that facility in 2003, and we have grown it to the current production capacity. What makes us quite kind of unique is that we don't have any requirements for additional expansion capital. So we're in this stage of our business cycle where we are returning capital to our shareholders through dividends, buybacks, and performance dividends.
Great, thanks. Rob, you can jump in.
Yeah, sure. We're 36 royalties in total. We just added a private royalty in Brazil from a company called M4E. We have 7 assets in either production, construction. There's 3 producing today, hoping that doubles towards the end of this year. So pretty top heavy. Top 10 would be just shy of 80% of our NAV. And as we mentioned earlier, we like to talk about the ABCs of hard rock. So high grade, low cost spodumene mines in Australia, Brazil, Canada. We do have 2 large brine assets in Argentina that should be up and running this calendar year. Brazil's probably the most exciting area for us with Sigma, Atlas, and now M4E. And then this week, we saw Winsome enter an exclusive option to buy the Renard mine and associated infrastructure. That's 60 kilometers south of their 59 million ton Adina asset. The prior owners had invested $900 million, and you guys know well, sometimes the second owner is the most fortunate. So that could have a huge impact on reducing their upfront CapEx, the overall project risk, and the footprint. And it's nice to see the stock react. It was up 13% last night and the night before. So that's some good validation for them. So that's sort of us in a nutshell.
So Rob, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about your team that makes the investment decisions. The royalty model is very interesting to me. You get some really important benefits versus, you know, as me as an investor, however educated I think I am, just trying to pick projects around the world. I mean, that's all you guys do, and I get diversification. I'd love to just hear more about how the investment team came together, like what their background in lithium, and then maybe How would you say they identify projects that meet your hurdle? What are some of the most important things that determine a successful lithium project?
Yeah, it's been a very material part of our success. You know, I think our CEO has been to over 115 site visits around the world. Our founder, our co-founder, probably an equal number. There's a very strong technical team. So having geological engineers, we have a QP, a qualified person under 43-101, a 30-year SVP of Corp Dev for Albemarle. So they can react very quickly without having to wait for all the technical studies to come out. And they've always looked through the original criteria when they started in 2018 was hard rock, high grade, low cost, low technical complexity, and safe jurisdiction. So, you know, we stayed away from places like Mexico, the Middle East, Africa. And I think, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll look to infill our existing map sheet. So it's very important to have that technical expertise and that proprietary network. And a lot of, if not all of the royalties, whether they're primary or secondary, were just bought with a negotiation with the counterparty. It wasn't part of any, you know, competitive process. Not to say that can't change, but to this point, that's been how it's operated.
And could you just quickly, from like a high level, tell us what are some of the important things you look at that tell you this is a lithium project with high potential?
Yeah, sure. I think scale is huge. You know, I think the we don't own a royalty on Corvette, but Patriot's been front and center on that. And that's over 109 million tons from, I think, just one of the pegmatites they've identified. So scale, grade, jurisdiction, and then I think the ability to maintain social license and have good relations with the government to actually get permits. And as we know, in all different commodities, that can sometimes be a huge gating issue. So, you know, Winsome trying to buy the Renard complex for, you know, $52 million after $900 million has been spent. They've spoken to government. They've spoken to the likes of Investment Quebec, CDPQ, who were shareholders in Stornoway. So having that license to operate and ability to move things forward is a huge advantage.
Great, thank you. Now, I just wanted to ask Aurora, because Lithium Royalty is in kind of the investment phase. Amerigo's been through some significant investment phases. They've ended up being very profitable for you. So I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things that go into making that decision that it's time to make to reinvest in the company versus just make sure that your operations are as profitable as possible? You've been through, I know, two major investment cycles. Just curious how your team evaluated those.
Sure. We have, as you mentioned, have gone through two major investments. The first one was basically after the acquisition of the NBC facility. We refurbished the plant. We brought it into North American standards, and that allowed us to see a significant jump in production. Initially, when we bought NBC, we were producing around 23 million pounds of copper a year. We're at 65 million right now. A second phase of expansion was to bring in additional deposits, not only the fresh tailings, which is the tailings that are coming from the day-to-day production of El Teniente, but also access to historical deposits adjacent to the NBC plant. So those two expansions have been very successful. We have an investment criteria. At NBC, we're operating at full capacity. There is really nothing else for us to do at NBC other than extend our contract as we have done before. Our contract currently runs to 2037, so we still have 16 years ahead of us before that contract needs a new termination date. We will be getting to that at the right time. So in absence of that, our investment criteria for other similar projects is very clear. We require projects that are of significant tonnage, working with tailings entails working with very low grades. So you need the tonnage to be significant for making this an economical operation. You need a sufficiently long time frame to recover your investments. The geographical location of the tailings vis-a-vis where they're going to be processed is a significant factor in considering the possibilities of investing in other projects or not. And of course, there's also the willingness with the mines that own the tailings to establish a true commercial partnership. We're not going to be interested in doing this processing of tailings for a fee. We want to have the participation in the business risk and the upside to copper prices, as has been the case in the NBC facility. So in absence of that, we are not pursuing any growth projects just for the sake of having a growth pipeline. We know what is required to make this economical. There are very specific drivers. If we find those drivers, we'll go with a different project. But in absence of that, we are happy with our operation and returning the surplus cash to shareholders, which was one of the fundamental investment goals that we had when setting up this company 20 years ago.
Yeah, you guys are in a great situation where you have a profitable asset that also gives you upside to copper prices. And so you can kind of just, you know, harvest that cash flow. And I guess the capital return decision is easier for you right now because you just don't have a growth project that really meets your hurdles at this point. But I wanted to maybe flip it over to Rob and ask you guys, how do you think about capital returns versus reinvesting in the business? What stage are you in? How do you think about a dividend? How do you think about buybacks, that sort of thing? What's your overall thoughts?
And Scott, maybe I can add an addendum to that, right? You know, what a royalty company has always historically been associated with, you know, with dividends and a higher rate of payout than normal companies. Maybe should we continue to think of royalty companies as that or as a portfolio? A company that I can buy then gives portfolio diversification. Like, is our dividends wed to the model of royalties?
Absolutely, and you can see that across the precious metals peer group. We're the only sort of pure play lithium royalty company, and you know, I think a dividend is very much in our thinking. Although I think it's a couple of years out, just given the price declines. You know, like I said, we deployed $50 million. I think we've bought 8 or 9 royalties now post our IPO. So it's definitely something we aspire to. It's not for the here and now. We have bought back shares. You know, the company went public in March of last year. I think we bought back about 155,000 shares. Insiders have bought $6 or $7 million, you know, post IPO when trading windows are open. So all of those things are things we think about and aspire to. A dividend until our income statement matures further isn't a short-term consideration.
Wonderful. Thank you, Rob. Yeah, you know, fantastic discussion, Scott. I think we've covered a lot of ground here. Thank you so much, Rob Arora, for your time. Like this has been a great discussion on both. We should do this regularly. It's a great like kind of state of the market for both these important metals, and you know it'll be fascinating 2024 to watch unfold.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks for having us.
Always good to be here.
Thank you. So we're gonna put this together in a podcast and get it out as well. And you know, we'll have clips from this as well. But yeah, great discussion. Just wanted to let everyone know, we just got the confirm. Grizzle Hard Money Volume 3 is coming out end of this month. Scott, we got Warren Pies confirmed as our lead speaker. It's gold, it's silver, it's Bitcoin. It's gonna be big. So we'll get everyone the details on that. Yeah, it's a great year for commodities. They're coming back, Scott.
It feels good, man. It's been a little bit, but back in the green, which I like. Yeah.
Guys, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with another one next week. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Aurora. Thanks, everyone.